everyone. Welcome to Safe Space, the ABA podcast. My name is Michelle Zeman. I am your host for the evening. Be sure to listen up for those code words so that way you can get your free CEUs. I am so excited to talk to this next guest. This is a subject that I have been very interested in learning more about, not just as a BCBA, but as an autistic person who does have, you know, pretty inflexible eating habits, I'm not going to lie. But that being said, I'm super excited to introduce Valerie Niger from the Autism Feeding Specialist. Welcome to the podcast, Valerie.
Thank you so much, Michelle. I'm really excited to be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you here. You know, this is a topic that I feel like it's talked about a lot, but I feel like this is also a topic that needs more attention, if that makes sense. I know that sounds very backwards, but when you think about it, we talk about how like some of our kids really need to work on eating certain types of foods. And, you know, some of us are like, how do we do this? And so for me, I actually really am happy that we're going to be talking together about this and, you know, getting right into feeding just in general.
Yes, I'm excited for this conversation too.
Yeah. Perfect. So, you know, when we first spoke, we talked a little bit about how you worked in an FA lab and a feeding clinic. So tell us about how your early experiences in that FA lab and the feeding clinic shaped your interest in feeding intervention.
Sure. So when we first met to talk about recording together, I shared about, I know, several experiences of my early experiences in ABA. And I first started learning and collecting experiences in this field all the way back in 2003, which sounds makes me feel ancient, in undergraduate school. So the initial FA lab I worked in and the feeding clinic are part of actually different experiences. So the FA lab was a part of a program run by Dr. Rick Smith at the University of North Texas, where I got my undergraduate degree and master's in behavior analysis. And the truth is, I only spent about a minute in that program as a volunteer one summer back around 2006. But then fast forward to 2014, and if anyone's listening to this and you're someone who is new to the field or just getting started, I think this is a great story about why it's so important to really kind of try everything and get involved in as many different projects or in research and volunteer opportunities, because not only is that going to help guide your preferences and help you learn what you do and don't like in this really quite vast field of behavior analysis, but it's also going to give you experiences on your vita that you can highlight. Because again, I spent this tiny amount of time in an FA clinic all the way back in 2006. And then in 2014, I became interested in a relatively new program that I learned about at my local hospital, where they had both an FA clinic, again, and a feeding clinic. And they were searching for a BCBA to join the program to straddle these two experiences and work in these two programs. And I was really interested in the position, but I had zero previous experience working in feeding, and I had no previous experience working in a hospital clinic. And so you can bet I highlighted my experience from all of those years ago back at UNT in the FA lab. And this was a really competitive position that they were hiring for. There was lots of applicants, and I got an interview. And I really think that that was that early experience working just that tiny, you know, amount of volunteer hours in this FA lab that really got my foot in the door and that caught their attention. And that also allowed me to, you know, then hone this experience working in feeding ultimately too.
Wow, that is so cool. You know, it's amazing what types of experiences that you can gain and how they can really help shape how you want to work in ABA as a whole. And again, just a reminder, ABA is not just clinical work. You know, there's a lot of subsets out there.
A lot. There's so much that you can do in this field. And I think it's great when you can get those diverse experiences, especially early on, to see what's the best fit for you. And also to evolve and change as a practitioner over time, too. You can become interested in new things. And I think that's a big part of my story, too.
Yeah. I'm so curious to know what aspects of that hospital environment initially drew you to the field.
Yeah. Well, some of the I shared that I didn't have previous experience in a hospital clinic, but I did have previous were experience working in a hospital doing research, a group design research. And the study that I worked on was teaching parent and child dyads feeding nutrition, and also providing coaching and motivational interviewing to support the families with making changes. And this was run by a social worker and a more traditional psychologist. There was no behavior analysis involved in this particular study. But that was the first toe that I ever dipped into the world of nutrition. And I really could see how it overlapped with behavior, because nutrition tells us a lot about what to do in terms of what changes to make around maybe our eating if we need to or we're wanting to do that. But behavior really kind of tells us how we do that and how do we change our behavior and routines to incorporate the healthy changes that we want to make or a new habit that we want to foster. And that really intrigued me. You know, I've always been sort of personally interested in baking and cooking and food. So I think it just, you know, kind of tapped into an interest that was already there for me and just showed me a whole other side of it. So when I saw that there was a behavior analytic feeding program in the future, kind of fast forward in my journey, and they were seeking a BCBA to work inside the program, I thought, well, hey, maybe this is my shot. I'm really interested to try this out or to learn more.
That is so cool. And you ended up working in that environment, I think, for 7 years.
Yeah, I did. Yes.
Oh, my goodness. So how did like being in that environment, straddling those, you know, between the FA lab and the feeding clinic and the hospital, enhance your understanding of feeding challenges?
Yeah, well, something really wonderful about both of these two programs is that they highlighted the opportunity for collaborating among disciplines. The FA clinic, which is called the Biobehavioral Program, really does just what that name implies, is bringing together kind of the biologic aspects and needs of the children with their behavior and communication and so forth. So in the program, we work closely with speech, you know, to develop communication goals, and medicine to understand, you know, maybe what medications the child was taking and how that might impact their behavior, you know, either negatively or positively. And then these all became things we could measure as we assessed and treated the children. You know, did that change in dose of medication have the intended effect? Were questions that we could start to ask, or is teaching this communication target functionally replacing the child's undesired behavior and those kinds of things?
You know, it's so amazing to hear about like that interdisciplinary nature, yeah, and hearing about how, you know, you work together, not just you yourself as, you know, a behavior analyst working in this particular environment, but working amongst other practices and other practitioners as well. And I mean, it really sounds like it was such a great program to just come together and collaborate.
Absolutely. I learned so much. And that was in the biobehavior side of things. And meanwhile, in the feeding program, you know, we also worked in a team, including both the biologic domains like medicine and nutrition, as well as the behavioral domains. So thinking about behavior analysis and psychology, and then speech and OT. So really for both programs, you know, is learning to really dig deep both into the biologic and the behavioral influences, you know, that come to bear on behavior, what we see happening in the environment, which was just really eye-opening, I would say.
I can only imagine, as somebody who works in just like a clinic where ABA is only offered, you know, it's really cool to be able to hear stories from people who work in that in an interdisciplinary team where they have multiple interdisciplinary areas. That being said too, in what ways did you feel that the interdisciplinary nature of your work informed your approach to working on feeding issues?
Yeah, so really when we think about the origin of feeding concerns that we're presented with in this field and working with kids, there are really multiple factors that influence the child's mealtime behavior. And when we talk about the diagnosis of pediatric feeding disorder, the very definition is that a child has impaired oral intake that is not age appropriate and is associated with dysfunction in one or more of four areas. And those areas are medicine, nutrition, feeding skill, and or in the psychosocial domain, which is kind of a fancy word for, you know, behavior and psychology. So and social emotional stuff, you know, and this is where behavior analysis lives, right? So we're just one piece of this really big pie, including these four other, or these three other, I guess, huge domains, and a domain that we live in next to other provider types. So we truly can't diagnose or really understand a child's feeding concern without digging into all four of these disciplines. And so to try to bring this to life for your listeners today, I want to share a tool with them that I've created using resources from my mentor, as well as an article by Gaudet and colleagues in 2019. And I can give you information to link that article in the show notes as well. But I want to share with listeners this tool that you can find at my website. So www.autismfeedingspecialist.com/safe space. So the name of the podcast. So autismfeedingspecialist.com/safe space. And what this tool can help you do is look at the child you are working with and really think about them from these four broad areas. So again, their medicine, nutrition, feeding skill, and the psychosocial domains. And to identify, or what I tell people to do is to go through and highlight on this tool, what are all of the factors or the influences that they see that are contributing to this child's feeding challenge? And that's going to really help you understand and help you to get a more holistic picture of this child's eating. It's also going to help you see the need for this collaboration and to see which members of the team you need to go to for support in each area or discipline. So this tool, I think it's really helpful. It's going to go to this link you can download the tool from. It'll go to your inbox, and then you will see the four domains of the PFD framework, and you can use it to investigate which concerns might apply to your client. And if you're working with autistic children, they say that 70 to 90% of them have feeding concerns. So you're likely already seeing a kiddo who has a need in this area. And I promise you it will be eye-opening. You know, there's so much going on with feeding, so many systems at play. And so you'll really walk away with, a broader understanding of feeding. You know, mealtime is not only influenced by behavior. It's influenced by so much more.
I am really looking forward to looking at that tool and subscribing to your website already, because I definitely feel like that's something that, you know, people need to know about. You know, in general, it really seems like resources for addressing feeding challenges really are pretty limited. Mm-hmm. I can tell you right now, just working in one center, someone was saying to me, oh, we can't really work on feeding issues. And it's like, okay, but what can we do to support? That being said, you know, how would you say this impacts families, and what strategies can be used to support them, you know, just outside of a basic like clinical environment?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I've seen, you know, families really struggle to find access to these kinds of services, like you said. And there are a lot of families who are already connected to, say, a behavioral provider, an ABA clinic, or things like that. So I see this as a real opportunity that if we can, you know, spread more knowledge or get more BCBAs to feel competent in this area, to really bring this into their scope of competence so that they can feel really comfortable and confident to support in this area. And again, knowing that they don't need to do it alone. We don't want them to do it alone. Really, you can team with these other providers, and there's safety in that, and there's also just so much support and so much more that we can do when we work together as a team. And I think, you know, that's a really a big part of the mission of what I do in the Autism Feeding Specialist and the blog and some of the resources and courses and things that I'm working on, is to really help spread the information, to help with filling in the gaps or get people kind of started around how do I think about these feeding challenges, or what can I do to support clients that I already see that I am identifying or having some of these feeding challenges. You know, what can my part be? What can I do? And how can I be more supportive in this area so that families feel more connected and that they're not just, you know, kind of waiting or wondering what they should be doing about this issue?
You know, it's definitely something that I feel like families need to have more insight on. You know, I know just some of the families that I've worked with in general, they've mentioned, you know, their child won't eat certain foods. Like, for example, they won't eat certain fruits. They won't eat brand new foods that pop up in their everyday diet, because it almost seems like the unfamiliarity of it all is just like, it's too much for a kid to handle, you know? And what I'm so curious about from your end, you know, that's just one part, right? But when it comes to other like severe feeding challenges, what are some of the most severe feeding challenges that you've encountered from your experience as an autism feeding specialist?
Well, especially in the hospital setting, I worked with a broad range of kids, both on and off the autism spectrum. You really see a lot of patients in a hospital setting. It's pretty fast paced. You get a tons of experience. And I think on the more severe end, I've seen kids who are, like you said, very selective in the way that they've excluded maybe an entire food group from their diet, or multiple food groups even from their diet. I've also seen kids who drink all of their calories. They refuse anything else orally. And then I've seen kids who struggle with getting enough calories from eating or drinking. And sometimes those can really turn out to be the most severe cases. I mean, there can come a point, even in these wonderful team interventions, where the choice becomes not what I think on the surface a lot of people think is the question of, well, should we use, you know, some kind of escape extinction-based programming here or not? But I think what really becomes the choice in those most severe cases is actually, it's a little bit of a different question. And that's, is it best for this child to have a feeding tube or to continue down the continuum of these more intensive behavioral interventions? And that's really not even a decision that I feel like I can make as a provider or that the team makes. What we can do is inform the family and talk to them about these options and what those various outcomes can be. And, you know, the decision to place a feeding tube, that's a, you know, it's kind of a semi-permanent or permanent solution, depending on how you want to think about it, for treating a feeding problem. And that's a real interruption to typical development. And eventually there may come a time when, in order to get off of that tube, we may come back to the same conversation again, where we need to consider some of the more intensive or intrusive behavioral procedures again. But those are the very hardest cases, you know, and I've seen that when working with a team and when everyone is playing their part to contribute and we're intervening on both the biologic and behavioral front, there are times when we, you know, the times that we need those conversations, I think, is much more limited. And I think, again, those are the most severe cases. If you're working in the home and community setting, you may treat a lot of kids and never get anywhere near a conversation like that, where you even have to talk about, you know, extinction, for example. But those are the saddest times. And your heart really goes out to families trying to make those really tough decisions for their kids and their family.
It is really heartbreaking. I mean, on my end personally, I've worked with two kids that have had feeding tubes respectively, and it is awful. I definitely, like, my heart goes out to them, because, you know, I wish I knew, right? I don't feel that I am fully competent in my like own practice to be able to say like, this is truly what happened. You know, I know with one of the students that I worked with, they were a teenager. And I remember that when we first found out about their G-tube, we happened to see, you know, what that process was like, trying to see if they would even be willing to eat food, you know. And again, going outside of my scope a little bit here, but it's also just out of a curiosity, like, what are the limitations? You know, and so I definitely can understand, like, especially because a feeding tube is a permanent, a pretty semi-permanent or even fully permanent thing. For the families that I've worked with that have children with G-tubes, it is that for them. It is permanent for them. So I can only imagine how hard that must be.
Yeah. It's a difficult decision. You know, I've also seen, though, where making the choice to to have that feeding tube can bring a lot of relief too. A lot of families who have been struggling for a long time with counting calories for their kids because they want to make sure that they're getting enough, with really struggling at each mealtime, you know, did they eat enough? Can they have one more bite? What else can I do as a parent? That's a huge burden to be thinking about that, you know, day in and day out. And sometimes, you know, like I said, there's a relief I think that can come with, you know, when in these most severe cases or when we're looking at, well, what are the options for moving forward here, where that can be something that gives them the relief that they know their child is getting enough. They know that their child is going to be growing. They know that they don't have to worry about what the child is consuming orally because they can supplement with the feeding tube as needed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can see it from that perspective too, of it being very like almost like lifesaver in a way, I guess. Mm-hmm. Would that be the correct term? It's like a lifesaver? Okay. Yeah. Cause you know, again, I see it from the perspective of like, this is a permanent thing that could be very disruptive, but at the same time, are we saving the child's life essentially? And mm-hmm. as long as, you know, the way that I view like the children that I work with is, as long as they're in a safe space, they're happy, mm-hmm. they are thriving in the way that they want to thrive, that, and of course, if they're healthy, mm-hmm. you know, that's what the goal is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, yeah. You know, so one of the things I know that with you being an autism feeding specialist and you have your blog and your website, which you talked a little bit about, mm-hmm. you know, with the fact that there's limited resources out there, how has your work helped bridge the gap in resource accessibility to families dealing with feeding difficulties?
Yeah. Well, you know, this gap kind of in access to resources really struck me in a new way after becoming a mom. You know, when I got started doing this work in feeding, I was single. And but after getting married and having two young kids, you know, over the years, they're 3 and 6 now, both of them at different times have come up against, you know, concerning medical issues, both different, both unique, but requiring specialty care. And for both of them, as we faced those issues, we also came against barriers to access, to finding someone to help them and to treat those issues. Honestly, we're feeling really scared in both of those scenarios and really feeling kind of at the mercy of someone being willing to go above and beyond for us, you know, someone who is willing to see us sooner or to network for us or to make a phone call to a provider that was out of state or whatever. And it's really fueled my passion for when I think about this kind of unique niche in feeding and behavior, and knowing that there are moms out there just like me, just desperately trying to get access for their child to a unique specialty. And in this case, it's this, you know, in feeding. And I want to shorten the wait for that person or for that mom or that parent. So in the winter of 2024, so earlier this year, I ran my first course to start teaching some of these skills to other providers and clinicians across disciplines. And something that is really rewarding for me is that now I have members from my first cohort, I had 25 students, are coming back to me and saying that they are doing this work and they're making some real progress. Some with, you know, one child or client, and some are, there was a couple of people in the group who are clinic owners, and they're running programs now with multiple clients and seeing change in what the child is eating and in their mealtime experience. And that really makes my heart sing. You know, that's accomplishing my mission, and it's really exciting. So,
That's so cool.
It's very rewarding. Yes.
Oh my goodness. Tell us a little bit about the course that you have too. You know, looking at your website, you know, you have this course that you're offering, and, you know, for those of us who are very interested in learning more, tell us a little bit about what the course consists of.
Yeah, I would love to. Thank you for that opportunity. So like I said, I ran the course first, earlier this year, back in February, and I ran it live. I'm going to be doing that again at the, like later this fall. I'm planning to do this again so I can have a group that's together and kind of moving through the course together or at their own pace, depending on each person's kind of decision. But I have, There's a kind of a six-step process for learning inside the course, and beginning with things like getting to know the various disciplines that we need to include and what the various roles of people in each of those four domains might be. So if you're looking at the medical domain, like what do you want to be asking the primary care provider about, or how do you want to include the speech or OT in this process, and where do you want to highlight, you know, the dietitian's expertise, and how do you kind of bring everybody together at the outset? And then moving into topics like, you know, how do you select food and working with a dietitian to do that, and also working with the kiddo to decide what are the things that are most interesting for them from a preference or interest standpoint that they'd be willing to try or interested in trying. And then also some strategies for our kids who have less vocal communication around how we can present choices to them as well, so that they can still have some choice and voice in what we're selecting to present. And then as we move deeper into the course, talking about what are those actual strategies, how do we use motivation and shaping and fading and all these great tools that we have in our toolbox to support kids with trying new foods and trying to teach them a growth mindset along the way too, is that this is a skill that they're learning to develop. They're learning to try new foods. They're learning to like new things. And that's something that we do get better at the more that we do it, both with an individual food and across foods. We can start to learn to like new foods more quickly the more we practice that, or the more we flex that muscle. So kind of embedding some of that, you know, information too, and learning for providers so that they can pass that on to kids and really teach that to their learners as well, that this is something exciting that they're building momentum around. And then I finish the course with, you know, some insights around troubleshooting and how do you get maybe new foods that you've introduced to the child's diet into their daily rhythm and the routine. And so they're actually eating those foods, not just when you're maybe practicing at a snack time, but when you're actually presenting those, or mom and dad are actually presenting those foods at home for mealtimes and things like that as well.
That sounds like such a great course. And, you know, I'm going to have to really look into this myself. As someone who does work with several clients who does have some feeding difficulties, you know, that's definitely something that I could find myself very interested in. And I hope that our listeners out there will also consider checking this out, because, you know, we do work with a lot of students who do have feeding inflexibilities. I know myself, as an autistic person, I grew up with a lot of feeding inflexibilities myself. And, you know, I wish that someone had worked with me a little bit more on that. Unfortunately, there were other things that ended up taking priority. And so, you know, that's why it's just that much more important to not only like feel comfortable enough to go outside and kind of like seek out that consultation, seek out, you know, these types of courses. But I think it's that much more important to, you know, see what else is out there that we can help our clients. So I'm really happy that you offer a course like that.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. And I want to go ahead and do our first code word. So our first code word is the word feeding. That is F-E-E-D-I-N-G. That is the word feeding. So when it comes to feeding interventions, you made this decision to focus on feeding interventions within ABA. What drove you to this choice, and how has it shaped your career trajectory?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, it wasn't an easy choice, I don't think. I think I honestly bounced around a little bit with the decision for a while, for various reasons. But ultimately, I'm so glad that I did. You know, I'm extremely passionate about behavior analysis. I've kind of focused in different areas over time. At the start of my career, and what really got me on fire for behavior analysis in the beginning was actually OBM. And I shared a little bit about how I, you know, found myself working in a research team for a small amount of time. I also worked in the home and community setting with kids and families. I worked in an inclusion school for a while, you know, kind of done some work across various areas. But I think what I shared before is I kind of have a personal interest, I guess, in food and cooking. I've always really liked, you know, cooking and putting food together. And honestly, that was something I got to do a lot. I learned in this working in this field or in this niche is, you know, helping families think about recipes and food and eating and using the dietitian support to inform, you know, what are the kinds of foods that this child really would benefit from eating more of? And then me thinking about, well, what are the things that I see them already preferring? And how can we, you know, put these things together? Or what are some food ideas? And just going to the grocery store and searching the aisles and thinking about a kid, you know, is something that I guess gets me excited. So in the end, it just kind of made sense for me. But I think for anybody who's out there listening and thinking about, you know, getting into a niche within behavior analysis, I recommend it. Now that I'm here, I feel really comfy here and cozy. You know, when you do something over and over, you gain confidence. You get a deeper understanding. You know, this is a really vast field, behavior analysis. And to really get a hold on something really well, to really focus, really helps with that. And also focusing on your passion means doing more of your favorite thing and less of everything else, right? And niching down helps people find you. You know, you start to get known for something. I've really started to build a really cool network, you know, getting going as, you know, using this name as autism feeding specialist for my blog and my website is, you know, it helps people find me. And when they have an interest in this or they want to learn more, that because I have this specialty area, it really narrows down their search and it helps them come to find me where I'm at in my little corners of the internet and things like that. So that's pretty exciting too. So I think being a specialist, you know, it's a lot of fun. It allows you the opportunity to get creative and innovate. It's fun here. You should join the waters. Yeah.
I love that so much. I love that so much. And you make such a powerful point about, you know, finding that niche, you know, again, I really get very interested in hearing about people who work in ABA and as a BCBA, but doing, you know, non-clinical thing, like not necessarily just working in an ABA clinic or working in homes or working in schools. Don't get me wrong, that's great. And it's a huge part of our field, but it's those niches that need to be recognized. And for me, being able to kind of like introduce myself to more people outside of that clinical world, for me, it's just, it's so cool because adventure is out there. I know that sounds so cliche, but adventure is truly out there. And it's not just in, you know, inside of a clinic wall or inside of the family's home, you know, it's everywhere. And so I'm so happy that like, that, you know, there are as many niches that there as there are, and that we're diving into more of those too.
I agree. I think it's really exciting seeing people become independent and trying things in health and fitness in that industry, or people leaning into OBM, or, you know, leaning into feeding or whatever it might be. Instructional design, you know, there's so many different areas that you can, IEP advocacy, there's so many. And I think it's wonderful to see people really find what they love and flower there. It's very cool.
It really truly is. And, you know, one thing that you mentioned with feeding and what you do is the creativity, which I love anything that involves, you know, being as creative and as autonomous focused as possible, I guess, if that makes sense, like focusing on the child's autonomy first. You know, which I love that so much. And, you know, of course, too, that involves designing specific interventions. And I know that within some of those interventions, there can be more intense feeding interventions. You know, of course, there's things like the non-removal of the spoon or the use of the Ripton chair. What are some of the ethical or practical challenges you've encountered within those more intensive feeding interventions?
Sure. Well, I think one of the remarkable things about my experience working in the hospital-based setting is I had a wonderful mentor that where I learned that we can use shaping by breaking down the steps to taking a bite to make progress with introducing new foods to kids, even as when it's really hard for them to try new things. And when we do get creative about selecting foods or doing really good assessment around identifying the right foods for that kiddo. And we can make it a lot easier in that way. And there's growing research supporting this approach now. You know, Gover and Hanley and colleagues have a newer article that's great. Amy Tanner has a nice case study and so on. And because we can do that in these more extreme cases where the child isn't willing to do anything with a new food, is that even when we do need to use a more powerful or restrictive procedure like extinction, is that we can sometimes target that in some of these easier steps in the shaping process. And that's a lot less aversive for a kiddo when you say, you know, you're going to use non-removal of the spoon, but the target is to just touch the food to their lip, as opposed to the target being, we're going to use non-removal of the spoon, but the target is to use that procedure to get the child to accept the bite of food into their mouth and to chew it and swallow it, sort of thing. That's a lot easier, right, of an ask, is to say, you know, let's just touch the steer lip. And when we get to that point where it's, you're using a lot of reinforcement, you've got a lot of great insight from the dietitian around how to target this goal at a time when the child is going to be hungry based on their hunger and satiety schedules and things like that. If using all these tools that are, you know, these resources that we have to create or craft a really nice intervention that's going to support the child with all positive strategies, when that's not working, again, we can start to introduce maybe something like extinction, but we can use it on an easier step like that. That might open the door. It does open the door. I've seen that happen for kids where then they don't need extinction at some of these higher steps in the shaping process where we're asking them to accept a bite of food into their mouth or things like that. So I think that's a really cool way to think about, yes, we do have some of these more intensive interventions or procedures, but that we can also use them in really creative ways, which I hope that I answered your question in that way.
Yes, no, I love it. I love it. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, positive-based reinforcement procedures and how, you know, you can get creative with that as well when you're designing those interventions. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on some of the latest research that you have, you've seen from implementing those positive reinforcement-based interventions?
Yeah. Well, there's a great review that was recently published in Behavior Modification by Williams and Sieverling, 2023. And it's called Behavior Analytic Feeding Interventions, Current State of the Literature. That's a great read for anyone who wants to a starting place to learn about what's new in feeding literature today. They do a great job of that in that article. But just to share a few here, I mentioned a second ago, there's that Hanley and Gover article, as well as that case study by Amy Tanner. Those are using shaping. There's also some really interesting research looking at the effects of video modeling from peers and how that impacts a child's eating. And then lastly, I think a longstanding tool in our toolbox that I'm seeing some more new research on is using fading. And I think we see some really powerful effects with just fading bite size, fading the bite, and also with using simultaneous presentation of food. So simultaneous presentation is when maybe you pair together, you know, a piece of broccoli and a piece of cheese. So something that's new and something that's novel for that child, and you put it together, and maybe the novel food is super small and the preferred food is big, you know, and you pair that together on the fork and give a bite. Or you can do that in a blended fashion too. So you've got a spoonful of yogurt where you've added just a drop of applesauce or something like that, right? So simultaneous presentation.
I love that, you know, and again, like, you know, I love that this can truly be applied in real world settings. You know, I love that these interventions that, you know, you work on within your practice can really truly be executed if, of course, done properly, you know, and again, like, it makes me that much more excited to, like, look at all the research and see what all people have. What all behavior analysts have done to help, you know, their children with those feeding inflexibilities, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, so, and we talked a lot about collaboration. We talked a lot about how, you know, about how feeding challenges can really often require input from multiple disciplines. Mm-hmm. We think about speech, occupational, we think about dietitians and medical providers as well. And, you know, it's so important to lean on all of those. I'm curious to know though, can you share a success story where that collaboration across all of those disciplines significantly improved a child's feeding outcomes?
Definitely. Well, right now I'm working with a kiddo who has a limited diet. He's selective. And he's grazing a lot. And I know that by working with his dietitian, that we can come up with a mealtime schedule that's going to optimize his hunger. So that when I go to Target, say a new food or a meal that he's going to be hungry, he's going to be more interested in eating. One of the things that I've learned from working with dietitians is that if you wait until a child is extremely hungry to introduce food or to offer a plate, they're going to be more selective than if you find a time when they're kind of in that sweet spot of they're hungry, but they're not like, you know, we always say like, I'm starving. They're not starving. They're just right. They're in that sweet spot. I'm starting to notice that I feel hungry. It would be a good idea if I started getting something to eat soon. That's kind of where you want to hit kids, both when you're introducing new foods, but also when you introduce a balanced plate of food in order to maximize in terms of getting the most volume or the most flexibility around eating what's on that plate. But again, in this example, I think that's going to encourage, you know, this kiddo that I'm working with a dietitian to figure out an ideal schedule for him. That's going to help him, you know, eat more of what he likes at mealtimes. That's going to support his growth. And then we're going to be able to use also the dietitian's nutritional analysis to inform what foods would be really helpful for him to target to get nutrients from food groups where maybe his diet is currently lacking. We're also working with the primary care provider to make sure there's not constipation, because that's been an issue in the past. When kids are constipated, they come to the table not feeling as hungry, not noticing their hunger as well, not being interested in eating, maybe not feeling like eating. Maybe their stomach already hurts because it's got stuff going on. You know, constipation really has a negative impact on kids eating. And so many kids, so many autistic kids who are selective eaters are constipated because they tend to be prone to those diets where they are eating more carb-based foods, lots more of those starchy things, and a lot fewer fibrous foods and things that really help with that motility. So, and I think the reason that is too, is those foods, those kind of those carb-based foods, processed foods, they're a lot more predictable than foods that are like produce or proteins or things that have a quicker expiration date, because those foods change quickly, even as from the time you bring them home from the grocery store until, you know, the time that you're throwing them out because you didn't eat them in time. You know, they change. They are not as good, or they may not be at the peak of the season. You know, when you eat a strawberry in June, wow, it bursts with flavor, right? But when you eat that same strawberry in December, it doesn't pop the same way on the tongue, right? It tastes different. And kids notice that, especially kids who are really sensitive. And so that makes it harder to eat those foods. So yeah, I guess I'm just backing up my point that those kiddos who are on the spectrum, who are highly selective, they tend to be constipated a lot. So working with a primary care really helps to ensure that we're doing what we can to eliminate that as a barrier to their interest in eating and or trying new foods. And then, of course, where speech or OT comes into the picture, we really want to have an oral motor assessment so that we can ensure that the child is safe for eating. Or if they do need diet modifications, like maybe they need to eat a lower texture food, something that's blended or chopped fine, et cetera, we want to have them inform that and give us those recommendations around how to prepare the foods in a way that are safe for the child, given their current skill with oral motor skills or swallow or things like that. The child's aspirating, we need to know that so that we can be thickening liquids or avoiding liquids or whatever we need to do there. So we really need to lean on their expertise in that area. That's usually speech that's going to have that expertise. Lean in on their area of practice in order to make sure that we're doing our due diligence in our area when we're introducing the foods or presenting the foods. So that's just kind of an example of how all those pieces can come together and how we, you know, lean on the whole team to make sure that we're moving forward in a way that's ethical, a way that is safe, and a way that's going to maximize progress for that child and family.
You mentioned something that really resonated with me, and it was about how different foods, certain foods don't taste the same throughout the season. And, you know, that certain carby-like foods will stay the same. It's more predictable. As somebody who, you know, grew up with those same types of feeding issues, I would say still as an adult, mm-hmm. I still have those same feeding issues. Mm-hmm. You know, so for example, I'm somebody who does eat McDonald's often. Mm-hmm. And I'm somebody who will do that not because I necessarily am like craving it per se. It's because it's predictable. It's within my comfort zone. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that a double cheeseburger mm-hmm. for me is going to taste the same every mm-hmm. time I have it. I mean, yes. There might be some very rare exceptions, mm-hmm. but yeah. That the point that you made really resonates with me, because even like I've been through that myself. Even like when my family has tried to put me on a gluten-free diet, it was an absolute nightmare. And it was like, I'm not safe. I don't feel psychologically safe right now, because you're giving me these foods that are not familiar. They're not safe. They're not the same, you know, fruits. Even you mentioned, you know, a fruit in December isn't going to taste the same as a fruit in June. It is true. It is very true. I can tell you, personally speaking, when it comes to different types of foods, I can tell, you know, when something is not the same in taste, and it's like mm-hmm. you almost get turned off by that food mm-hmm. immediately because of the fact that it's not the same. And so I appreciate you bringing light to that, just because for me personally, like I grew up with those issues, and still to this day, I still have those types of feeding inflexibilities just because of the fact that, you know, for me, I have predictable and safe foods, but those predictable and safe foods are more your carby foods that end up leading to constipation, that end up leading to more, you know, I guess digestive issues as well. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to say thank you for bringing that to light.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think everybody experiences to some degree, I mean, food is comfort, right? We all say that. We all, I think, can identify with the fact that having something predictable or comforting is something that we all look for sometimes when it comes to eating. And sometimes that, I think, is important that we need to offer that, right? Is give kids that what's predictable, give them what they're expecting or wanting. I could go on about that. Food is wrapped up in a lot of things, comfort and love. And like you said, your history, the way you were raised, what you remember smelling at home, you know, there's so many pieces to that. And I think that the goal, you know, when it comes to introducing new foods to kids, is not to force them to eat things that they don't want to, but to give them the opportunity for access, right? So that they can have new experiences where they're not limited from going to, you know, a friend's house because there's nothing that they can eat there, right? We want to give kids the opportunity to try new things so that they can experience having a play date or a sleepover, because there'll be something that they can eat when they're there, or going on a family vacation or a trip because they can eat at a restaurant and they can order something off of the menu. You know, when kids can't do those things, it's limiting to their access, and it's also limiting to their family and the kinds of things and experiences that they can share together too. So yeah,
that's a beautiful analogy to, you know, access. Don't like looking at it from like, you know, you as somebody who is going to live your life by going to other people's homes and going out to restaurants, you know, addressing it from that like natural standpoint of, by doing these interventions, by working on these things, you can actually start to almost like open up your world because of it. And I think that Absolutely. That's such a beautiful thing to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really important reason to work on this and to target these kinds of goals. It doesn't always have to be because the child has, you know, the most limited diet or the most severe case, but also just opening them up to the benefits of being able to even explore a city, their culture through eating in some ways. You know, that's an experience that some kids might aspire to have. They don't even have access to that opportunity without having the ability to be flexible when it comes to eating, or to be willing to try new things, and learning that they can be safe in doing that is, I think, a really important thing for kids to learn.
Absolutely. I agree. I completely agree with that. And I want to go ahead and introduce our second code word of the podcast. And that word is team. That is T-E-A-M. That is team. Couple last questions before we go tonight. I would love to know from your perspective, you know, what are some essential trainings or even just essential things to know that providers should have when working with children who experience feeding difficulties, you know, like different red flags, like allergies and intolerances, like what kinds of things should we know?
Ooh, that's such an excellent question. You know, I have to say, I was recently reading about this. There's a chapter in a newer book as well called Behavior Analytic Approaches to Promote Enjoyable Mealtimes. I have it somewhere close to me. I couldn't say the exact chapter off the top of my head. I apologize. But they have some great ideas in there around how to train your team. But I think some things that I would encourage or things that come to mind for me, I think is, to your point, is make sure that we ask and know what are the child's allergies. Find that out from the pediatrician. We can ask that question to them and to the family. Any food tolerances that the child might have, making sure that anyone on the team who's going to be addressing any mealtimes, whether they're targeting new foods or targeting the mealtime or not, just knowing those things is so important when we work with kids. I think to know to look for certain red flags, like any kind of change in coloring as the child is eating. If they have a very wet sounding voice when they're talking after eating, that can be a red flag for some issues. If the child is coughing or frequently gagging during a meal, sometimes gagging is a natural response to trying new things, but sometimes gagging is also a red flag for other concerns. So coughing and gagging is something that we want to look for, collect data on, tell our SLP and OT friends about, make sure that they're assessing and looking at that as well. And then I think having basic training on what do you do when a child is choking, or CPR training and so on and so forth for everyone on the team who might be touching this kiddo who is working on trying new foods or mealtimes and things like that. I think those are some of the things that come to mind for me, I guess.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I think that, you know, as basic as CPR, we all should have CPR training anyways. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the basic job requirements, mm-hmm. but I definitely see why in, you know, this case, it's so mm-hmm. important to be able to have CPR training, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Making sure that you are ready to respond in a moment of crisis, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Valerie, I want to thank you so much for coming on tonight and telling the world about, you know, your story of being the autism feeding specialist. I love that today we got to dive into a lot of different things with relation to feeding interventions, with working with different types of feeding, feeding complexes and feeding challenges. So again, I cannot thank you enough for coming on to the podcast tonight. And I wanted to ask you, where can our listeners find you and what are some things you would like to promote?
Oh, thank you so much. Well, thank you for having me. This has been a lot of fun for me too, talking about my favorite things. So I've had a great time. Thank you very much. Where people can find me is at my website, www.autismfeedingspecialist.com. If you're interested in the course that I talked about today, you can find on, you know, my kind of home menu bar, there's something about my course wait list right there that you can go to. Or if you go to autismfeedingspecialist.com/waitlist, I think you can find it that way as well. You can also find me on Instagram at autismfeedingspecialist as well. I think those are the key places to look. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Valerie. I'm so happy that we had this conversation. And thank you, everyone, for listening in tonight. I have been your host, Michelle Zeman, and I will see you on the next one. Take care, everyone. Bye.